radio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com.
I'm Darren Weeks, sailing those same oceans again. If the United Nations has their way, we could be charged a lot of money for sailing those oceans. And for mining the oceans, $500,000 and $1 million a year after that. The command and control structure is being put in place on all of us, ladies and gentlemen, and control of the seas, control of 70% of the Earth's surface. Ultimately, it's going to be 100% of the Earth's surface. But this Law of the Seas Treaty is something that we're going to be covering tonight on this broadcast, so stay with us. This is the May 2nd, 2005 edition of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, and I hope you'll stay with us tonight as we have some very vital information to cover tonight. And every American needs to be hearing this, and I do hope you folks are spreading the word to all of your, to the unchurched population, so to speak, those who are not in this congregation of truth seekers that we have in the audience. And I do appreciate you folks, I really do. I appreciate you seeking the truth and tuning in to broadcasts like this one because you want to know, you have the courage to face reality, as so many in our society don't have the courage as you try to share information with them. They don't want to hear it. They want to put their head in the sand. But what happens to people when they put their head in the sand, folks? What part of them is exposed? And that's what you got to keep in mind. If you don't want to get that part bitten, it's best to face reality and try to deal with the situations as they occur. As I said, this is May 2nd, 2005. Very cold here in Michigan, by the way. We thought we were going to have, for a while there, it got up to 80. And now we've had a cold front. Could have used a little bit of that global warming that they're always talking about. As I was out barbecuing just before the broadcast a little while ago. And, man, it has really turned off cool here in southern Michigan. At any rate, I don't want to waste too much time. There's some information, folks, before we get to the Law of the Seas Treaty. I came across this article called Tsunami Rebuilding Could Deforest Island, Green Groups Say. And I think Chris mentioned this last Thursday on this program about my talking to my father who lives in Alabama. And it's kind of interesting how literally the logging industry has been attacked for years. And Chapter 11 of Agenda 21 is on combating deforestation. And from talking to my father, I find out that there's a lot of timber being chopped down in that state, in the state of Alabama, and I would imagine other states as well. And all of this wood is being shipped overseas to Iraq to board up buildings. And it's kind of interesting because you know what's going to end up happening. They're going to end up, after this is all done, blaming all of this deforestation on your development. They're going to say that we human beings are destroying everything. We're building too many houses. There's too much development going on out there. And you folks are to blame for all these trees being chopped down. Therefore, more strict standards are going to have to be put upon you because you have deforested the land. And all the while, in reality, they went and destroyed Iraq, and now they're boarding all of those buildings that they destroyed up. And eventually, the rebuilding process will have to take place as well. And where is that timber going to come from? You betcha, it's going to come from the developed countries. And so this is another article, Tsunami Rebuilding Could Deforest Island, Green Groups Say. And this is from the National Geographic News. This is dated April 26, 2005. If Indonesia's tsunami survivors do not get an immediate and massive delivery of timber for reconstruction, the country faces devastation of what's left of its forests, environmentalists warned today. The warning comes in a report published by, that's right, the World Wildlife Fund Conservation Organization. The WWF estimates that 4 to 8 million cubic meters, or 140 million to 280 million cubic feet of logs will be needed to rebuild ASA in Indonesia over the next 5 years. The WWF report was produced in partnership with the Indonesian policy research institution Greennomics. The reconstruction estimate includes housing, schools, and other government buildings, and thousands of fishing boats. The low end of the estimate assumes that the maximum use of building techniques that are less timber-intensive, making more use of materials such as concrete. The report says that the demand for so much timber cannot be met by Indonesia's already ravaged and threatened forests. It called for the international community to make immediate donations of timber. Aceh province bore the full force of the tsunami 4 months ago, a series of giant waves triggered by a massive undersea earthquake off Sumatra Island killed 240,000 people in the region and left more than 410,000 homeless. Entire towns and villages were swept off the map. And, of course, we have to always ask the question, was the tsunami bomb used, the one they developed in 1944? Was this another created crisis? You know, but the point here of bringing this up, as I already said, what's going to happen when all of these forests are deforested? You know, this is going to be, is this another Hegelian dialectic situation in the making? As our timbers are going over to Iraq and to board up buildings, apparently, according to my father, who is awake on these issues, at least to a large degree, historically. And so just wanted to give you that heads up there, folks. Okay, before we get to the law of the seas, I want to cover one more thing here. As the Codex Alimentarius goes forward, this information comes from John Hamill's organization. Consumer access to dietary supplements in the USA is being threatened by illegal FDA actions. At the UN Codex Alimentarius Commission, where the FDA has been working hard to create a mindlessly restrictive global trade standard for vitamins and minerals. At the 28th General Session of the UN's Codex Alimentarius Commission, between July 4th to the 9th, 2005, barring a miracle, a very restrictive global trade standard for vitamins and minerals will be ratified. So in other words, they have this commission coming up this July 4th through the 9th, so that's not too terribly far away, a couple of months. Codex standards can be imposed on the USA via member in the WTO and via regional harmonization through the expansion of NAFTA and CAFTA, that is the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. These trade agreements threaten to force the USA into a hemispheric equivalent to the European Union. Now, this is why this isn't good. In the UK, despite over a million signatures on petitions gathered in British health food stores opposing harmonization of the UK vitamin laws to a mindlessly restrictive European Union food supplement directive, the UK government told consumers, "We don't care how many signatures you get on your petition. The UK is a member of the EU, and we're harmonizing to EU law whether you like it or not." The same thing will happen in the US and Canada unless we kill the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which is scheduled for the fast-track vote in May. This month, folks, CAFTA would plunge us down the slippery slope to the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which threatens to harmonize or make the same all laws from the Arctic Circle to Tierra del Fuego. More than just our dietary supplement laws are being threatened here. CAFTA and FTAA threaten the destruction of thousands of American jobs as they'd be outsourced to the third world where there is much cheaper labor, just as happened via NAFTA, only this would be much worse. CAFTA and the FTAA threaten to totally destroy our country. And, folks, I would suggest to you that that's of course, that's by design. That's what the intention is. I mean, there's no way you can look at this and not say that that's what the intention is. This is a direct attack on our sovereignty, but we can stop it, he says. Now, you're urged to go to stoptheftaa.org and fill out the forms to your senators and congressmen. I don't know what good that's going to do. I don't want to pee in somebody's punch bowl here, but a lot of people did that for NAFTA, and these little critters, these little Congress critters. And what does Congress mean? Congress. There are a bunch of cons operating in there. But these people went ahead and passed it anyway. But anyway, they urge you to go to stoptheftaa.org, fill out the form to mail your congressman, or you can go to www.citizen.org/trade/CAFTA, C-A-F-T-A. That's citizen.org/trade/CAFTA. And, folks, it wouldn't hurt to educate your local lawmakers on this as well. I'm not sure what can be done at a state level, but it certainly wouldn't hurt to have these people educated about this information. But we strongly urge you to pass that along. One other thing I'm going to mention, of course, we have, and I've covered this once before, from May 8th to the 10th in Shanghai, China, we have the World Toilet Expo. You can be sure to go to worldtoilet.org if you want more information about that. So that's just a little bit of the news that's going on. Now, this Law of the Seas Treaty, I got some information here. This piece was published originally in the New American. It was written by William Norman Grigg, and it's an excellent piece. It's called Sink the Law of the Sea Treaty. The Bush administration is pushing for ratification of the United Nations Law of the Sea Treaty, which would give control of the oceans and their riches to the world body. And, folks, we've been covering oil on this program for quite some time now, and we've had Lindsay Williams on the broadcast. And this gives you, I think, the oil situation that we've been covering gives you an idea of just how badly these people are, how greedy these people are, and the kind of control that they lust for. But they're not satisfied with just a little control. Folks, they want it all. And sadly, people are letting them have it all because they're putting their heads in the sands, those that are confronted with information, and many who are not confronted, I mean, the vast majority of the people are ignorant about this stuff. This connects, by the way, this Law of the Seas Treaty to Agenda 21, of course. Chapter 17 of Agenda 21 calls for the protection of the oceans, all kinds of seas, including enclosed and semi-enclosed seas and coastal areas, and the protection and rational use and development of their living resources. And I'm sure there's other parts of Agenda 21 that this covers as well, that connects to. I'll read you just a little bit of this from Agenda 21, Chapter 17. It says, degradation of the marine environment can result from a wide range of sources. Land-based sources contribute 70% of marine pollution, while maritime transport and dumping at sea activities contribute 10% of each. The contaminants that pose the greatest threat to the marine environment are in variable order of importance and depending on differing national or regional situations, sewage, nutrients, synthetic organic compounds, sediments, litter, and plastics, metals, oil, hydrocarbons, polycyclic or aromatic hydrocarbons. Many of the polluting substances originating from land-based sources are of particular concern to the marine environment since they exhibit, at the same time, toxicity, persistence, and bioaccumulation in the food chain. There is currently no global scheme to address marine pollution from the land-based sources. So the desire for control is there. The pretense for control is there. And hence we have the Law of the Seas treaties, which actually began a lot sooner than Agenda 21 did. They've been working on this for a long time, ladies and gentlemen. I will post, by the way, the entire a link to the Law of the Seas treaty website on AmericanExpose.com after the broadcast tonight. American spelled with a K, not a C. But beginning with William Norman Griggs' information, he says, conservative Americans who consider George W. Bush a champion of national sovereignty have been shocked to learn that the president seeks Senate ratification of the U.N.'s Convention on the Law of the Seas treaty, also called LOST, L-O-S-T. Despite the Senate's refusal thus far to ratify the treaty, it went into effect in 1995, and elements of the vast regulatory apparatus it outlines are already in operation. When fully implemented, LOST would consummate the largest act of territorial conquest in history, turning 7/10 of the Earth's surface over to the jurisdiction of the United Nations. Did you hear that, folks? It would turn 7/10 of the Earth's surface over to the jurisdiction of the United Nations. It would create a mammoth bureaucracy to regulate exploration of the ocean depths and commercial development of the seabed's riches. The UN would also be empowered to collect royalties on seabed mining, thereby providing the world body with a potentially enormous independent source of revenue to fund its agenda for global governance. None of this seems compatible with the Bush administration's so-called reputation for flinty-eyed defense of our national independence. Yet during her Senate confirmation hearings in January, Secretary of State Connie Lisa Rice stated that the Bush administration would certainly like to see LOST pass as soon as possible. And we very much want to see it go into force, she said. She claimed on January 18th that, quote, joining the convention will advance the interests of the United States military. The United States, as the country with the largest coastline and the largest exclusive economic zone, will gain economic and resource benefits from the convention. And the United Nations has no decision-making role under the convention in regulating uses of the oceans by any state party to the convention. Unquote. He continues here. He says, Rice's unqualified endorsement of the Law of the Seas Treaty lets several important questions go begging. For instance, why is it necessary to sign a UN treaty in order to enjoy economic and resource benefits from ocean territory we already own and control? If the UN would have no role in regulating the use of oceans within our sphere of influence, how would it be in a position to grant us the economic and resource benefits referred to by Rice? But nobody present at Secretary Rice's confirmation hearings was inclined to ask such pointed questions. Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Richard Lugar, a Republican from Indiana, as if it really matters what party he belongs to. They both work in tandem for the mutual destruction of the country, ladies and gentlemen. He's a noted Republican internationalist who supports ratifying the Law of the Seas Treaty. He was delighted by Rice's rapturous endorsement of the pact. He said, quote, I particularly appreciate your response on the Law of the Sea Convention. He said, making specific references to Rice's assertion that the treaty was compatible with U.S. national security interests. He continued, he says, that's clearing up an issue sometimes raised by opponents of the convention. And then he referred to widespread criticism of the pact as an infringement on U.S. sovereignty. He also cited Rice's statement that the Law of the Seas Treaty, quote, does not provide for the authorized taxation of individuals or corporations. And he says, I cannot think of a stronger administration statement in support of the Law of the Sea Convention, unquote. So great is the administration's desire to implement the Law of the Seas Treaty that its supporters are blatantly misrepresenting the treaty's prevention. Now, I want to stop here for just a moment, folks, because we got a guy out of who's originally out of Pittsburgh, and now he's syndicated. And this guy claims to be against the New World Order. He claims to be an anti-globalist. And yet, he's a huge Bush supporter. And the whole time he talks Democrat this, Republican that. And he covers a lot of good information. And I'm just going to say his name, Jim Quinn. Jim Quinn, the Quinn of the Morning Show. And I've listened to him during the Clinton administration go on and on about how evil Clinton is and all the evil things that he did, and yet he's done nothing but be an apologist for the Bush administration. And folks, when you hear people on the air doing that kind of stuff, you've got to know, anytime anyone on the air is talking about Republicans, they focus on Republicans versus Democrats, that should tell you something about that kind of person and how controlled they really are. Either they're very deceived, and I know that he knows enough, he couldn't be deceived. You're either very deceived or very controlled. But at any rate, they're a part of the dialectic of the controllers, and they're helping to implement the plan. Continuing with William Griggs' information, he says, contrary to Rice's assertion that the United Nations has no decision-making role under the convention in regulating uses of the ocean by any state party to the convention, Article 2, Paragraph 3 of the treaty explicitly states, the sovereignty, and this is a quote, the sovereignty over the territorial sea is exercised subject to the convention and to other rules of international law, unquote. As applied to our country, the phrase territorial sea refers to territory presently belonging to the United States. Under the Law of the Seas Treaty, the U.S. sovereignty over that territory would, in principle, be ceded to the U.N. Rice's claim that LOST does not provide for or authorize taxation of individuals or corporations is similarly dishonest. However, getting to the truth of the matter requires wading through page after page of murkily written bureaucratic language. Article 170 of LOST describes the enterprise, quote-unquote, a U.N. organ that would supervise all scientific, commercial, and military use of the area, all regions of the world's oceans, including the seabed and super-adjacent atmosphere, beyond the territorial limits of coastal nations. The enterprise has yet to be created. The International Seabed Authority, and we'll post their website as well, and its ruling council, however, are up and running in Kingston, Jamaica. The ISA claims that the power to enact rules and regulations governing the use of the seas, Article 171 dealing with funds of the authority, lists assessed contributions and funds received by the authority in connection with activities in the area. Annex 3, Article 13 of the treaty, sets out the financial terms of contracts between the UN's enterprise and private businesses seeking to develop seabed resources. Now listen to this, folks. Any private firm seeking to conduct mining operations must pay an administrative fee of $500,000 in addition to an annual royalty to $1 million, with those figures subject to revision by the council within a year of commercial proceeding. The bottom line is they think they own the land. They think they own the minerals. They think they own the ocean and the water. They think they own it all, including you and me, by the way. Within a year of the commercial production, the treaty continues, quote, a contractor shall choose to make his financial contribution to the authority by either A, paying a production charge only, or B, paying a combination of a production charge and a share of net proceeds. Contractors who choose the first approach predictably will have to pay a much higher fee than those who choose the latter. But in either case, they will be paying excise taxes to the UN-created enterprise. The UN and its controlling elite have long sought to establish a revenue stream circumventing national legislative bodies, particularly the U.S. Congress, collecting royalties on the commercial use of the seabed, an incomparable treasure trove, would leave the UN awash in literally trillions of dollars. The riches of the ocean depths were inaccessible until after World War II, when Western commercial interests, particularly U.S. energy companies, began to develop the technological means to explore and mine the seabed. Oceans cover 71% of the Earth's surface and are storage tanks for minerals washed from the land by streams, floods, and tides, observed the late Dan Smoot, a former FBI agent and widely admired constitutional scholar. He says each cubic mile of seawater contains 165 million tons of solid material, including all precious and industrial metals. Enormous deposits of critically important materials, oil, gas, sulfur, salt, diamonds, they all lie beneath the water of the oceans. The oceans are also rich in foodstuffs that man already uses, and in organic substances which man will learn to convert into food. Seawater itself abounds in vitally important minerals such as bromine and magnesium. An estimated 10 trillion tons of manganese, vital for producing steel, and not found in the continental United States, is found in potato-shaped nodules scattered across the ocean floor. Harvesting those nodules became possible in the late 1960s when the U.S.-based firm called Deep Sea Ventures invested $200 million to develop the means of excavating the seafloor at depths of 1 to 3 miles. Even without U.S. participation, the UN-created International Seabed Authority is supervising the process of mapping out new underwater territories. Quote, a group of ocean mappers at the University of New Brunswick, or UNB, is redrawing the world's oceans under new rules set by the United Nations, divvying up trillions of dollars worth of natural resources in huge chunks of the seafloor, unquote, reported CBC News on January 29, 2003. They continue by saying countries have 6 years to make the case for where their boundaries should be, creating what UNB mapper David Monahan calls the largest land grab in human history. Monahan says, quote, I think of it as the world's oceans being divided up by this treaty. That's two-thirds of the world's surface. It's almost mind-boggling to think about how big it is. Unquote. The vast ocean floor contains an estimated 20% of the world's oil and gas deposits, folks, as well as other potential energy sources such as frozen methane. This Monahan guy continues, he says, the amounts of methane we know about are probably enough to run the world for 80 to 100 years. The seas would yield resources adequate to meet the energy and food needs of the growing human population if, if private sector were permitted to develop them. Does that sound familiar? Folks, we got to take a break. You're listening to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, and we're going to continue here on the other side of the break. Go to the website, by the way, AmericanExposé.com. American spelled with a K, not a C, as there's much information and research to be done there at the website. And also SweetLiberty.org is another good research site. And I strongly urge you to do your research. And don't forget Sam and Trish's website, TheInformationCorner.com. We'll continue with the Law of the Seas Treaty Convention in just a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to the FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Who is God? The answer is next on today's Creation Moment. Here's our Creation Moment's host, Ian Taylor.
Did you know that the Bible never tries to convince the reader that there is a God? As surprising as that sounds, it's absolutely true. The Bible's very first words begin by identifying God, but nowhere does the Bible try to prove that there is a God. The very first verse of Genesis reads, quote, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Here we learn that the God of the Bible is our Creator. We also see here, although less clearly until we look at the next two verses, the prime actor in creation is the Father. In the second half of verse 2 we read, "And the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters." Now it is clear that the Trinity is being presented. Here is the Holy Spirit moving over the as yet unformed earth, anticipating the people yet to be made, who would serve as his temples. Verse 3 then opens with, "And God said," and that simple phrase introduces the very heart of the scripture, the Word of God himself. This is the very Word of God who would come and take upon himself our earthly form in order to accomplish our salvation. So here, even in Genesis, we have the beginning of God's revelation to the person and work of the Son of God, our Savior. Truly, all scripture has been given to make us wise unto salvation.
For a printed transcript of today's program, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. That's 1-800-422-4253. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Of the ocean floor, folks, and if the United Nations has its way, you're going to pay $500,000 to be able to mine them, and $1 million a year after that. You're listening to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks. Welcome back from the break. We're covering the Law of the Seas Treaty tonight, folks, and I want to continue here because time goes by fast, and we're going to put the links, by the way, as I said earlier, to the convention, the Law of the Seas Treaty, so you can read it for yourself and do your own research. We try to do that whenever possible. We already linked to Agenda 21, but the International Seabed Authority, they have a website as well. They say on their website, the International Seabed Authority is an autonomous international organization established under the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and the 1994 agreement relating to the implementation of Part 11 of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The authority is the organization through which states, parties to the convention shall, in accordance with the regime for the seabed and ocean floor and subsoil thereof beyond the limits of national jurisdiction, hereafter called the area, established in Part 11 and the agreement, organize and control activities in the area. Organize and control. And folks, that's what it's all about. It's about organizing and controlling. Never forget, it's about control. Continuing with William Griggs' information on the law of the seas we were sharing before the break. He says the seas would yield resources adequate to meet the energy and food needs of the growing human population if the private sector were permitted to develop them. The parallels between that and the oil situation that we have going on today are just remarkable, aren't they? He says, under customary law dating back to the time of Justinian, the seas were free to be used by anyone with adequate means to do so. On that principle, the development of deep sea resources beyond national borders, including the seabed, should be open to entrepreneurs willing to take the necessary risks and make the necessary investments. But the UN, true to its Marxist pedigree, is seeking to lock down control over the seas and exploit them for its own ends in the name of mankind. Socialism is based on a proposition best phrased as follows: what's mine is mine, what's yours is ours. That is to say, through the coercive power of the state, private property becomes collective property, managed by a supervisory elite. And folks, they're calling it communitarianism today. The same logic lurks in the expression common heritage of mankind. That seemingly innocent phrase was coined by the United Nations in 1967 when the world body was led by Burmese Marxist U Thant, who praised founding Soviet dictator Vladimir Lenin as the inspiration for the UN's concept of peaceful coexistence. The UN would eventually attach the common heritage label to the Antarctica, the atmosphere, outer space, and the Earth's oceans. By designing something, the common heritage of by designating something the common heritage of mankind, the UN seeks to globalize Marx's formula from each according to his ability to each according to his need. Only a few societies have developed the technological means to make profitable use of the ocean depths or outer space. But the UN insists that the benefits that flow from those pioneering efforts must be shared with all nations, including those suffering under corrupt collectivist regimes that make such innovation possible. Now, folks, people who are suffering under those regimes, you think the people are going to benefit from any wealth from the oceans? The Law of the Seas Treaties, the Law of the Seas Treaty represents the first and most significant application of the UN's common heritage concept. According to Article 136 of LOST, the area and its resources are the common heritage of mankind. Article 137 elaborates that all rights and the resources of the area are vested in mankind as a whole, and on whose behalf the authority shall act. This triumph of maritime Marxism was a joint production of the UN and the administration of conservative Republicans, with the administration of conservative, quote-unquote, Republican, Richard Milhouse Nixon. In December 1969, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution banning the exploration of the ocean floor beyond each nation's territorial limits, pending the completion of an international seabed treaty. In May of the following year, U.S. President Richard Nixon offered a counterproposal calling on all nations to adopt a treaty renouncing all claims to undersea resources beyond a depth of 200 meters. All undersea mining and other resource development, whether carried out by a government or private interests, would pay royalties to a supervisory international body, the envisioned enterprise. The resulting revenue would be distributed as developing assistance to third world nations. In brief, Washington's outraged reaction to the UN's attempt to claim that the oceans was to provide the world body with a detailed schematic for accomplishing its design. I want to say that again. He says, in brief, Washington's quote-unquote outraged reaction to the UN's attempt to claim the oceans was to provide their answer to it was to provide the world body with a detailed schematic for accomplishing its design. Beginning in 1973, the UN conducted a series of international conferences to create a workable convention on the law of the sea. In those negotiations, Washington displayed an almost indecent eagerness to consummate Nixon's proposed sellout. In a desperate bid to win acceptance for an early draft of the treaty, reported the September 2, 1976 San Francisco Chronicle, then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger offered, quote, to help developing nations set up their own international seabed mining operations, unquote. That is, the U.S. taxpayers would subsidize the giveaway of mining technologies to economic competitors in order to entice those same nations to agree to a treaty intended to lock up UN control over the oceans. That proposal is enshrined today in Annex 3, Article 13, Subsection D of the Law of the Seas Treaty, which describes one objective of the enterprise as inducing seabed contractors to agree to transfer mining technology and provide technical training to the authority and to developing states. Incredible as it may seem, Kissinger's offer didn't placate the socialist bloc that dominated the Law of the Sea conferences. Calling themselves the Group of 77 Developing Nations, or G77, this socialist lobby induced the UN General Assembly to approve a, quote, declaration on the establishment of a new international economic order in 1974. That declaration was a manifesto demanding what Doug Bandow of the Cato Institute calls, quote, totalitarian global management, including, quote, redistribution of natural, financial, and technological resources. When LOST was completed in 1982, the Reagan administration, confronted with insurmountable opposition in the Senate, refused to sign the agreement. 12 years later, the Clinton administration signed the agreement, but declined to submit it for Senate ratification, recognizing that the votes simply were not there. With the ratifying votes from 50 UN member states, the treaty went into force 10 years ago. To date, 145 nations have ratified the pact, which in 2002 was described by Singapore's Tommy Koh, president of the third UN Conference on the Law of the Sea, as, quote, a comprehensive constitution for the oceans, covering, quote, every aspect of the uses and resources of the sea, unquote. If made available to commercial development, the seafloor could provide ample resources to deal with our increasing energy needs. Turning management of the seabed over to the UN would provide that corrupt body with unfathomable wealth, potentially running into trillions of dollars to fund its agenda for global control. However, largely because the Senate has yet to ratify the Law of the Seas Treaty, the enterprise has yet to go into operation. But this does not mean that the U.S. government has remained aloof from the LOST process. As with other elements, listen to this, folks, as with other elements of the comprehensive UN agenda, Washington has been implementing elements of LOST piecemeal, just like they're doing with the Kyoto Protocol, doing it piecemeal legislatively. During a briefing at the June 2004 G8 summit at the Sea Island Resort off of Georgia's Atlantic coast, Jim Connington, chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality, was asked about a possible U.S. role in creating the enterprise once the Senate ratified the Law of the Seas Treaty. Connington's revealing answer described the Law of the Seas Treaty as an important component that we've now been working with for nearly 30 years. The U.S. government has actually been implementing nearly every chapter of the Law of the Seas Treaty since it was first adopted. We are now looking for Senate ratification in order to make some improvements to sections regarding the very economic enterprises we talked about, especially the deep-sea mining components of that, unquote. The extent of the Bush administration's plans to implement the Law of the Sea Treaty is illustrated by the Bush administration's U.S. Ocean Action Plan, published in December 2004. The objectives set forth in the action plan include the following, quote, support accession to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. As a matter of national security, economic self-interest, and international leadership, the Bush administration is strongly committed to U.S. accession to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. Unquote. That was declared in the action plan urging Senate ratification of the treaty, quote, as early as possible in the current Congress, unquote. As noted previously, U.S. ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty will place our territorial seas under U.N. jurisdiction. Additionally, the connectivity of waterways to the seas will provide the means of expanding U.N. jurisdiction over rivers and other tributaries within the borders of a nation. See, that's the point. They want it all, folks. They're not going to be satisfied with just the oceans. They want your lakes. They want your ponds. They want your streams. And, of course, they want your private water wells. It's about control. Control of all water. If you can control food, you can control people. If you can control water, you can control people. This principle is obliquely alluded to in the Bush administration's action plan. Quote, the administration will continue to work towards an ecosystem-based approach in making decisions related to water, land, and resource management in ways that do not erode local and state authorities and are flexible to local conditions, unquote. This will require creating strong partnerships between federal, state, tribal, and local governments, the private sector, international partners, and other interests. Granted, language of this sort is difficult for most people to understand, since it was written by bureaucrats who deliberately avoid clarity of expression. Digested into simple English, the statement previously mentioned means that most U.S. waterways would be considered subject to the terms of the Law of the Seas Treaty. A suitable example of ecosystem-based resource management is the federal government's Whitewater to Blue Water Initiative, or WW2BW. The State Department and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration describe the WW2BW as a sustainable development partnership in the form of an international alliance of government agencies, UN-connected bodies, and radical environmental groups. Although many Americans have never heard the phrase sustainable development, the concept it refers to poses a critical threat to the way of life they enjoy. Unveiled by the UN in the late 1980s, sustainable development describes a vision in which the UN, acting as custodian of the planet, would regulate all human interaction with the biosphere. The concept is laid out in exhausting detail in Agenda 21, the mammoth eco-socialist blueprint created at the UN's 1993 Earth Summit, and I believe that was 1992 that actually took place, in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. David Sitars, editor of the authoritative version of Agenda 21, points out, quote, effective execution of Agenda 21 will require a profound reorientation of all human society unlike anything the world has ever experienced, a major shift in the priorities of both governments and individuals, and an unprecedented redeployment of human and financial resources. This shift will demand that a concern for the environmental consequences of every human action be integrated into individual and collective decision-making at every level. Implementing Agenda 21, Sitars continues, will require the active participation by, quote, farmers and consumers, by students and schools, by governments and legislators, by scientists, by women, by children, in short, by every person on Earth, unquote. To put the concept of sustainable development into practice, the UN seeks to carve up the world into bioregions, which would be governed by councils of stakeholders, representatives of government agencies, international organizations, environmental activist groups, and so on. This is exactly the same mechanism described in WW2BW. It is intended to implement numerous UN treaties, including the Law of the Seas Treaty, the WW2BW. And again, that is the Whitewater to Blue Water Initiative. It is intended to implement numerous UN treaties, including the Law of the Seas Treaty. Washington has spent millions of dollars to promote the program in collaboration with several foreign governments and numerous UN agencies. Limited at present to the Caribbean, the WW2BW is described as a blueprint for future efforts in Africa and the South Pacific. Obviously, it would also serve as a blueprint for ecosystem-based resource management in the United States once the Senate ratifies the Law of the Seas Treaty. And it's reasonable to suspect that the LOST would serve to extend the UN's global jurisdiction in much the same way that it perverted the interpretation of the Constitution's Interstate Commerce Clause and has been used since the New Deal era to expand federal jurisdiction over practically every commercial activity within the United States. Because all waterways are connected, all activities such as farming, manufacturing, and recreation having any impact on those waterways would be brought under the UN's jurisdiction. It's possible to believe that a liberal democratic president would be able to muster the political capital needed to secure Senate ratification of LOST. But as President Bush famously said following the November 2004 election, he intends to spend his political capital to enact his legislative agenda. Because of misplaced partisan loyalty, there is presently little outspokenness and opposition to the Law of the Seas Treaty among Republican senators. The February 7th Human Events published comments from 10 Republican senators who were asked about ratifying the Law of the Seas Treaty. Only one, Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, whose speeches we've read on this broadcast, was willing to go on record in frank opposition to the pact. He said, quote, "I will fight to the bitter end to oppose successful ratification," unquote. Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee was studiously unequivocal. He said, quote, "Both personally and representing leadership, I am not going to say how I would vote yet." That was Bill Frist. Other GOP legislators were dismissive. George Allen of Virginia said, "I'd have to look at it really closely again. I don't think it's critical," yawned Alabama's Jeff Sessions. Mike DeWine of Ohio said, "You know, I haven't looked at it yet." It's entirely possible that the administration will seek to do with the Law of the Seas Treaty what the first Bush administration did in 1992, to secure Senate approval of the UN's International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. That treaty was ratified by anonymous voice vote after midnight as the Senate adjourned for vacation. No record exists as to the names of those senators who voted for that treaty. Given the obvious desire of Senate Republicans to support the president's agenda without incurring criticism from their constituents, it's not difficult to imagine the Senate's leadership using the same cowardly tactic to ratify LOST. But this must not be allowed to happen twice before ratification of LOST has run aground on the formidable reef of public opposition. And that's, of course, the good thing, folks. As Roger Mundy said on this broadcast, talking about the power of instruction, instructing your legislative leaders, they said, "But this must not be allowed to happen twice before ratification of the Law of the Seas Treaty has run aground on the formidable reef of public opposition. Americans committed to our national independence must ensure that the treaty is scuttled for good." In other words, vigilance, folks. Liberty requires eternal vigilance, and that's very important. That was the piece, Sink the Law of the Seas Treaty, by William Norman Grigg, originally published in The New American. We have a little time left here, so I want to share with you some information from this International Seabed Authority website. They say the authority, which has its headquarters in Kingston, Jamaica, came into existence on the 16th of November, 1994, upon the entry into force of the 1982 convention. The first Secretary General of the Authority, Satya Nandan, was elected in March of 1996, and the authority became fully operational as an autonomous international organization in June of 1996, when it took over the premises and facilities in Kingston, Jamaica, previously used by the United Nations Kingston Office for the Law of the Sea. Meetings of the authority are held at the Jamaican Conference Center in downtown Kingston. Anyway, they give you a little background here, and I don't want to bore you with all the nitty-gritty details, but that's the International Seabed Authority, and we'll have that link up on AmericanExpose.com after the broadcast tonight. Now, from the Oceans and Law of the Sea website, a division of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, dated the 10th of December, 1982, they say that the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea lays down a comprehensive regime of law and order and the world's oceans and seas, establishing rules governing all uses of the oceans and their resources. It enshrines the notion that all problems of ocean space are closely interrelated and need to be addressed as a whole. The convention was opened for signature on the 10th of December, 1982, in Montego Bay, Jamaica. This marks the culmination of more than 14 years of work involving participation by more than 150 countries representing all regions of the world, all legal and political systems, and the spectrum of socio-economic development. At the time of its adoption, the convention embodied in one instrument traditional rules for the uses of the oceans, and at the same time introduced new legal concepts and regimes and addressed new concerns. The convention also provided the framework for further development of specific areas of the law of the sea. The convention entered into force in accordance with its Article 308 on 16th November 1994, 12 months after the date of deposit of the 16th instrument of ratification or accession. Today it is the globally recognized regime dealing with all matters relating to the law of the sea. The convention comprises 320 articles and 9 annexes governing all aspects, and there's the key here, folks, governing all aspects of ocean space. And believe you me, when they say all aspects, they mean all aspects, such as delimitation, environmental control, marine-specific research, economic and commercial activities, transfer of technology. See, you're getting into your socialism once more, and the settlement of disputes relating to ocean matters. Some of the key features of the convention are the following. And again, I'm reading right from the United Nations website. Coastal states exercise sovereignty over their territorial sea, which they have the right to establish its breadth up to a limit. Not to exceed 12 nautical miles, foreign vessels are allowed innocent passage through those waters. Ships and aircraft of all countries are allowed transit passage through straits used for international navigation. States bordering the straits can regulate navigational and other aspects of passage. States made up of a group or groups of closely related islands and interconnecting waters have sovereignty over a sea area enclosed by sea lanes and air routes in which all other states enjoy the right of archipelagic passage through such designed sea lanes. Coastal states have sovereign rights in a 200 nautical exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, with respect to natural resources and certain economic activities, and exercise jurisdiction over marine science research and environmental protection. All other states have freedom of navigation and overflight in the EEZ, as well as freedom to lay submarine cables and pipelines. Landlocked and landlocked and geographically disadvantaged states have the right to participate on an equitable basis. Once again, there's your socialism. An exploitation of an appropriate part of the surplus of the living resources of the EEZs of coastal states of the same region or subregion, highly migratory species of fish and marine animals, and accorded special protection. Folks, we got to go. There's a lot of research that can be done on this. I strongly urge you to go to the website after the broadcast tonight. We'll have these links up and do the research on this. This is the law of the seas. It's all about control. I look at this as being very similar to the control of oil that's going on in Alaska and various other places. And never forget, the United Nations is an extension of U.S. foreign policy. They admit as much on the State Department website. God bless you. We'll talk to you
Amazing Alan, supermarket scene.
Guys?
Yes, Alan.
You want me to cut in front of these 15 people who are waiting in this very slow line?
That's right, Alan, and cut in front of the big guy with all the tattoos.
Why am I doing this?
To illustrate that people have a basic understanding of what is right and wrong, like knowing it is rude to cut in front of people.
But everybody knows that.
Right, and since there is a basic